Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. Austrians went to the polls Sunday in a rerun election because the results of the first vote in June were annulled due to irregularities. The results could see the frontrunner Norbert Hofer of the anti-Islamist Freedom Party chosen, making him Austria's first far-right president since World War II. Analysts have said Sunday's race between far-right candidate Hofer and his opponent, Alexander Van der Bellen, a Green Party member, was too close to predict in the hours before polls opened, with some polls showing Hofer slightly ahead. VOA correspondent Luis Ramirez is in Vienna.
The facing of campaign posters really symbolizes the anger that exists, the intolerance that exists on either side of the other. And so the hope that many voters are expressing is that beyond this election, Austrians can once again find some middle ground to move forward and to put their differences behind them, to work through them. There are voters who tell me that they are all for helping people who need it, and that the world can't just stand by and watch the people of Syria suffer. At the same time, a more reasonable plan has to be devised in order to be able to help the people while looking after the interests of ordinary Austrians.
That's Luis Ramirez in Vienna. Meanwhile, Italians are voting Sunday in a referendum on constitutional reform that could gauge anti-European Union sentiment in the country. Voters will decide whether to approve a proposal by pro-EU Prime Minister Matteo Renzi to increase his powers so he can push through economic reforms for which the government has said would bring political stability in Italy. VOA News. The remains of former Cuban leader Fidel Castro were buried in eastern Cuba early Sunday morning after 9 days of nationally mandated mourning across the island. The ceremony at Santa Efigenia Cemetery in Santiago de Cuba was made private at the last minute, barring journalists from around the world from witnessing the service. Castro died on November 25th at age 90 after years of declining health. Fidel Castro's ashes arrived Saturday afternoon in Santiago de Cuba, the city where he started the Cuban Revolution in 1953. The procession followed in reverse the route Castro and his rebel fighters took as they advanced on the capital from the Sierra Maestra Mountains before taking power in January 1959. Former U.S. Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein is turning to a federal court in her effort to recount the state of Pennsylvania's ballots from the recent presidential election that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was widely expected to win but lost to billionaire businessman Donald Trump. Stein dropped her attempt to have Pennsylvania recount the votes after a state judge ordered her to post a $1 million bond. As Syrian government forces continue to push deeper into the rebel stronghold of eastern Aleppo, analysts say the wider geopolitical ramifications are being felt across the West. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In eastern Aleppo, Syrian government forces backed by Russia are gaining ground. Analyst Michael Stevens of Britain's Royal United Services Institute says victory here for President Bashar al-Assad may force a change of strategy from Western governments.
Assad's winning, and I think it's pretty safe to say that he will be there at the end game, and whoever negotiates a peace deal in Syria will have to negotiate with Bashar al-Assad.
Stevens says Europe and the United States have backed moderate opposition forces, but the desire to end the bloodshed could trump those alliances. Ending the war may come with the price of keeping Bashar al-Assad in power. Even then, analysts say Syria's future stability is far from guaranteed. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Tolerance and unity were the themes of a rally attended by thousands of people in Indonesia's capital Sunday. The peace rally was held after two massive protests that were recently mounted in Jakarta by conservative Muslims to demand the removal of the city's first Christian governor in 50 years. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Clote is away on assignment.
My registration is far away in the western region, Isikadakatan. So clearly, the time constraints couldn't allow me to even travel that far to go and vote as a special voter.
Some problems with voter registries as Ghana begins early voting.
La CENCO a noté des divergences qui nécessitent des échanges directs.
Chollet told reporters that disagreements remained over important questions, including the interpretation of the Congolese constitution.
Political talks mediated by the Catholic Church in DR Congo suffer a major setback as the president's supporters withdraw.
A majority of our accidents we do is taxi drivers that have caused the accident, and they're always overloaded as well, which is never a good thing. So you end up with so many injuries on the accident scene.
And we continue with our series on the investigation into the chaos on South African roads. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ghana held a special early voting period ahead of its December 7th polls to allow security forces, electoral officers and journalists who work on election day to cast ballots. But there were some major problems with voter registries during Thursday's polls, so the Electoral Commission says they are going to hold another early vote on Sunday. Francisca Kaka-Fawson reports from Accra.
Many special voters across the country could not vote because they could not find their names in the voter registry, making it impossible for them to cast a ballot. In Accra, journalist Ebenezer Afenyidazi had checked to ensure his name was in the register at the designated constituency the day before. But when he showed up at the polls, he was asked to travel to the western region where he first registered.
And my registration is far away in the western region, Isikadakatan. So clearly, the time constraints couldn't allow me to even travel that far to go and vote as a special voter. I do not know what I'm going to do, but I am hoping that the EC may rectify the problem.
Authorities say this is the first time the special voters exercise has faced such problems. The EC says the omission of names arose because of problems in how some electorates applied for special voting. In other cases, the commission said people went to wrong voting constituencies to cast their ballot. In a statement, the commission announced those who could not vote the first time can try again on December 4th. Constitutional lawyer Nanesa Ntibedietu warns this could lead to multiple ballots from individuals during the second round of special voting and even during the main elections if the Electoral Commission does not improve the transparency or its voter registration system.
The biometric verification devices have counters. How are those counters going to be useful in determining how many people have already voted and in any polling station, and therefore how many people are left to vote, and thereby also ensuring that those who voted already do not get to vote again. So there has to be a clear path to determining which list is going to be used so that there's no confusion. I think there is a danger. I'm never in favor of two-day voting.
The Electoral Commission says it is putting in place measures to avoid allowing people to vote multiple times on December 4th and 7th, including providing all political parties a list of those eligible early voters who already cast ballots. Francisca Kakra-Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, political talks mediated by the Catholic Church have suffered a major setback with the withdrawal of the president's supporters. William Claus has more from Kinshasa.
For more than a month, the National Episcopal Conference of Congo, the influential body which represents the Catholic Church, has been working to avoid a crisis in the DRC. The institution known as SENCO has been mediating between the presidential majority, President Joseph Kabila's political alliance, and the Rassemblement, a large coalition of opposition groups. SENCO is hoping to facilitate an agreement between the parties that will reduce the chances of unrest on December 19th, the last day of Kabila's second term and the date on which the Rassemblement says the president should leave office. On December 2nd, however, the presidential majority announced that SENCO's efforts have been a failure, blaming flagrant contradictions within the Rassemblement. The two parties had not met face-to-face during SENCO's weeks of mediating. Several hours earlier, Abbé Donatien Chollet, SENCO's Deputy Secretary General, had conceded that all was not well.
La SENCO a noté des divergences qui nécessitent des échanges directs.
Chollet told reporters that disagreements remained over important questions, including the interpretation of the Congolese constitution. Elections had not been organized in 2016 as they were supposed to be, and the presidential majority argues that the constitution allows Kabila to stay in office beyond the end of his second term until polls are held. In a separate agreement with a smaller opposition coalition signed in October, the next election has been provisionally scheduled for April 2018. The Rassemblement claims that the constitution is clear. It wants Kabila to step down on December 19th and a transitional government to lead the country to elections, which it says should take place in 2017.
Sur ces divergences, la SENCO estime que...
Despite the differences, Chollet said SENCO believes a compromise is still possible and reaffirmed the church's willingness to help, but warned that the DRC risks sinking into an uncontrollable situation without an agreement. VOA spoke with Augustin Kabua, a spokesman for the Rassemblement, which remains supportive of SENCO.
C'est une question de la mauvaise foi de la part de nos amis de la majorité qui voient que la violence...
He accuses the presidential majority of acting in bad faith and of seeing violence as the way to solve their problem. For the Rassemblement, Kabua said, we are still counting on the mediation of SENCO because it is the only way of finding a way out of this crisis for the country. Hans Hobeck, senior Congo analyst at the International Crisis Group, questions whether the presidential majority was ever interested in a compromise.
SENCO did call both parties to sit around the table. So it's clear that the majority feels a little bit cornered. I don't think it was ever genuine in engaging these talks. It mainly wanted to give the impression to the international community, and I think as well to the region, that they exploited all avenues to enlarge the agreement that they concluded in October. But I don't think they were really prepared to go to any concrete concessions.
If this does mark the end of SENCO's intervention, which has the support of the international community, the risk of violence on December 19th will likely grow. A protest organised by the Rassemblement in Kinshasa on September 19th descended into violence, and the United Nations say that security forces killed more than 50 people. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
A vintage plane, Air Raleigh, aiming to fly to 10 African countries, stopped in Kenya Sunday on its way to Southern Africa. The event is raising funds for UNICEF, BirdLife International, and the reforestation group called Seed Bombing. But the pilots of the 20 old biplanes had a bit of trouble on their trip before reaching Kenya. They were detained for 2 days in Ethiopia because of paperwork problems. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
They're on a mission in the air and on the ground. It is a mission to raise money and awareness for wildlife conservation in Africa. Adam Morant is one of the 20 pilots who landed in Kenya's national park.
I'm very privileged and happy that I can be that, and hopefully we'll have more of those kind of events that we can make sure that it's aware for the wildlife and the parks and good support for them.
One rally sponsor is BirdLife International, which is hoping to create awareness of the decline of vultures in Africa. The vintage Air Raleigh began 2 weeks ago in the Greek island Crete. After landing in Ethiopia, where the 40 crew members were detained for 2 days for allegedly entering its airspace illegally, the Raleigh team made it Kenya, where aviation fans turned out. Organisers of the local event say the historic biplanes from the first half of the 20th century created a lot of buzz and gave a lift to Kenya's tourism.
We were
trying to create an opportunity to showcase Kenya's tourism. And to do that, you can see the crowds that have turned up. What this will take is take the story to the world. We want Kenya to be seen as a star destination. We want people to come to Kenya.
The crew has already covered 5 countries, 5 to go. The trip ends in Cape Town on December 17th. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
An animal welfare organization says there is widespread online trade of exotic animals as pets, including monkeys, lions, tigers, cheetahs, wolves, kangaroos, foxes, snakes, and more. The Born Free USA report found the enormous popularity of internet shopping has significant repercussions for the trade in exotic animals that were never offered at pet stores. Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the abusive nature of breeding wild animals and the danger of having one as a pet.
For many years, Born Free USA has been talking about the risks in the exotic pet trade and the fact that people who have chimpanzees or tigers or other exotic animals as pets run a real risk of either disease transmission or violent outbreaks and attacks, even human death, not to mention the animal's death as well. But we also wanted to start to look into the way these animals are traded. I think it used to be more a case of flea markets and trade days where people could find exotic animals, even lion cubs for sale. But now with the advent of the internet and the increasing availability and accessibility of animals and commerce on the internet, we're finding that there's more and more trade happening online. And so we did a 3-month investigation looking at 4 different websites that sell animals, literally online, where anybody can click whether they want a monkey or a tiger or other big cat reptiles and see what they can find. And the results were really shocking. We found on those 4 sites in just those 3 months, nearly 2,000 ads with more than 3,000 animals for sale, all different species available, and I think most shocking, very little in the way of information about the animal's history, their health, or requirements that people who actually buy these animals have any training at all in how to care for them. So the new online report about downloading cruelty that Born Free USA has shows how easy it is to acquire exotic animals online and how dangerous that is for the unwitting consumer.
So is it legal then to make these types of purchases online?
There are only a few laws at the federal level that govern the trade in animals as pets when they're exotics. For example, the Captive Wildlife Safety Act, passed by Congress in 2003, prohibits the interstate movement of big cats if they're going to be kept as pets. But then different states have different laws, some completely prohibiting the exotic animal trade, some completely allowing it, and then still other states that say it's okay to sell certain exotic animals, say reptiles and bears and primates, but not big cats. And so that makes enforcement very complicated, especially when the trade is online and you don't always know where the seller actually is located.
These purchases can be done from anywhere in the world then because it is online.
Exactly right. The internet has opened up literally a global trade in wildlife. And of course, we know that that happens with wildlife products like ivory or rhino horn or sea turtle shell. But now we also know that it's available for exotic animals that are live for the pet trade. They can go anywhere in the world and come anywhere in the world as long as they can get through customs.
What is the danger of having an exotic pet in your home?
It's an animal welfare risk for the individual animal. And of course, we have to remember these are animals that are biologically hardwired for a wild life. So putting a primate, for example, a vervet monkey, in a cage where their teeth might be removed or their nails filed down or removed to try and make them less dangerous when they bite or scratch, keeping them tethered for their entire lives, this is an incredible animal welfare risk. But then we also know that there's a risk to humans as well. These animals, exotic animals, can bite, can scratch, can attack. They can also transmit diseases, such as turtles that may have salmonella. And then, of course, there's a risk to society as well. There's often cases where these animals escape. Just this past month, there was a pet kangaroo that escaped from someone's house. And when that happens, it's a drain on society because they have to devote the resources to capture the animal, try and find the owner, and if they can't, care for the animal or perhaps ultimately euthanize the animal.
That was Adam Roberts. He's CEO of Born Free USA. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis. For nearly three decades, every December 1st, we've heard about the tragedy of AIDS, and it is a tragic. The virus has killed millions of people, often in the prime of life, and it's left behind millions of orphans. But now, on this year's World AIDS Day, VOA's Carol Pearson has a message of hope.
It's been a long, frustrating search for a vaccine against AIDS. And although there are a lot of hopes pinned to a new vaccine trial that's just begun in South Africa, there are reasons that a vaccine has been so elusive. Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Health has spent his career studying the AIDS virus. His agency is co-funding the trial.
The challenge that we have with an HIV vaccine that's much different from the challenges that we have with any other vaccine is that we've got to do better than natural infection.
With other viruses, the body begins to fight the infection on its own. When scientists develop a vaccine, they find a way to mimic the virus, so the body makes an immune response to protect itself. Not so with HIV. A few years ago, an HIV vaccine was tried in Thailand. It cut the risk of getting HIV by 31%. Not good enough to produce a vaccine, but good enough for scientists to think they were onto something. A new trial in South Africa uses a strengthened version of this vaccine. Earlier this year, a small study in that country showed that the vaccine candidate was safe and promising enough to use in a major study. But Fauci is mindful that just because it shows promise doesn't mean it will succeed.
Anytime you do a vaccine trial, more vaccine trials fail than are successful. The whole rationale for doing a trial is to see if it does work. We have no idea whether it will work or not.
More than 5,000 people will participate in the trial. Some will receive the potential vaccine, others a placebo. All will be counseled on how to avoid getting the HIV virus. The results of the trial won't be known for at least 3 years, but in order for it to be successful, the vaccine has to protect at least half of those who get it. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
They are among the most hated facets of South African society. Minibus taxis. The men and a few women who drive the vehicles often drive extremely recklessly. South Africa's Automobile Association says minibus taxis are involved in about 70,000 road crashes every year. Thousands of people are killed and injured in these collisions. Despite this, the taxis remain the backbone of the country's public transport system and contribute a lot of money to the economy. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports in another installment of our investigation into the chaos on South African roads.
Veteran paramedic Ian Watson races to the scene of a road crash. A minibus taxi has collided head-on with a sedan after veering into oncoming traffic.
A majority of our accidents we do is taxi drivers that have caused the accident, and they're always overloaded as well, which is never a good thing. So you end up with so many injuries on the accident scene.
The taxis are supposed to carry a maximum of 16 passengers, but it's often double this. Watson's colleague, Victor Furendijk, says he's always amazed at the danger that minibus taxi drivers expose their passengers to in their haste to make as much money as possible.
Basically, the typical minibus taxi tends to be unroadworthy. I've seen many cases where taxis drive around on, it looks like racing slicks, it's that bad. The drivers themselves very often are in possession of invalid permits or fraudulently obtained driver's permits or licenses at least.
Julia Nyamayawo says she'll never forget this intersection in Johannesburg. A few months ago, she was on her way to work. The pedestrian light turned green, so she began walking across the road. A taxi careened through a red traffic light and hit her.
And then they said I fly up, and then I hit the pavement by my head and my left side. My body still sore, especially my left side, and then the left arm is quite sore. The veins are not working properly.
A map of scars is etched on Nyamayawo's head and face. She can't walk properly and can't bend to use the toilet. Yet Nyamayawo still uses taxis because they're cheap. But speak to taxi operators and they'll almost always deny that they're dangerous drivers.
It's not easy for a taxi driver to make an accident.
But that's not true. Just a few minutes ago over here, we saw a taxi go through a red light and smash into a car. This happens many times every day across South Africa.
Yeah, I do agree with you, but to be honest, I really don't blame ourselves for the way we drive.
As a paramedic and a lawyer, Furan Dake interacts a lot with taxi drivers involved in collisions. He says they're almost always arrogant, driving as if they own the roads.
So into direct oncoming traffic, for 3, 4, 5 blocks, you see them utilizing turning lanes to continue straight. They would stop wherever they want, which is extremely dangerous. Blocking emergency vehicles, blocking emergency lanes, but this is common. This is what's accepted and endorsed within South African society. It irritates everyone, but no one does a single thing about that.
Howard Dembowski heads the Justice Project, a non-profit that monitors South Africa's traffic sector. He says taxi operators drive so dangerously because they don't get proper salaries. Instead, the more trips they make, the more they get paid.
If you want them to drive like maniacs and drive on the sidewalks, etc., etc., that's a great way to encourage them to do so.
Dembowski blames the state for failing to instruct taxi drivers to be responsible, safe road users.
We do not require the person who drives a minibus taxi to undergo any form of specific training. All they have to do is go and get something called a professional driving permit, which requires them to have a criminal record check, an eye test, a health check, which is pathetic, and pay an additional fee.
Dembowski says the minibus taxi sector remains unregulated and a law unto itself because the government is terrified of it.
Because if those guys decide to go on the rampage, we're in trouble. Not only does it stop the transportation of 15 million people per day, it also stops all other traffic, and they've proven this on multiple occasions.
When taxi drivers go on strike, the economy loses billions of rands. Nurses, factory labourers, police officers, people who deliver food can't get to work. Taxis block the highways. The country stops. The taxi industry therefore has a gun against the government's head, says Dembowski. South Africa's Transport Department did not respond to questions about the taxi industry. Dembowski maintains the taxi sphere is in effect a criminal syndicate that rules by fear.
If there were to be any industry in South Africa that could be defined as being the mafia, it would be the minibus taxi industry.
According to state statistics, an estimated 20,000 taxi bosses own 300,000 vehicles and employ 650,000 drivers and conductors.
Traffic.
At a taxi rank in Soweto, a portly man wearing shiny black shoes and pants and a pink golf shirt munches a greasy chicken leg. He owns 6 taxis here. He says he only hires tough drivers to drive as fast and aggressively as possible, as taxis compete for more passengers and more money. He adds that he's proud to say that most of his drivers are ex-convicts.
They committed crimes long time ago, so they still have that mentality of being rough. They do carry guns, knives.
Why do they carry weapons?
Because if I do something wrong to you on the road, then you say something, then I show you that thing to make you be afraid. And I can even put out the gun and say, I'm gonna shoot you.
He smiles and lifts his shirt to reveal a pistol tucked into his pants. The taxi industry occasionally bursts into violence, with rival associations fighting one another for power and money. Police gather at the scene of another collision involving another minibus taxi. Witness Donovan Hermans says the taxi sped through a red light, hit a bus and spun into a wall.
The taxi driver broke his neck. They had to pull him out in a neck mount and then put him into the ambulance.
Motorists drive slowly past the crash. Most don't even bother looking at it. They, like their compatriots, have become numb to the death and destruction caused by taxis. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is VOA and you're listening to Netland Africa. Up next, the latest in sports. Music from African Collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. In Netland Africa Sports, Nigeria won the Women's Africa Cup of Nations for an eighth time after a 1-0 win over host Cameroon in front of a capacity 40,000 crowd in Yaoundé. A late goal from Desire Operanozie was enough for Nigeria to retain the trophy they won in Namibia 2 years ago. The Super Falcons have dominated this competition, winning all but two of the 10 editions played so far. In a repeat of the 2014 final, Cameroon finished as runners-up again despite enjoying massive home support. Ghana finished as bronze medalist after a 1-0 win over South Africa. Meanwhile, Gabon has appointed former Spain manager Jose Antonio Camacho. The 61-year-old will have only 43 days to prepare the team before the country hosts the Africa Cup of Nations, which starts on January 14th. Camacho, who has been out of football since he was sacked as China coach in 2013, has signed a 2-year deal to fill the vacancy left by Jorge Costa's dismissal last month. Camacho enjoyed a highly successful playing career. The former left-back was capped 81 times by his country and made over 440 appearances for Real Madrid, a club he later coached. His first competitive match as Gabon coach will be the Nations Cup opener against Guinea-Bissau. Camacho will also be tasked with trying to qualify Gabon for the 2018 World Cup finals in Russia when qualifiers resume in August. In Sudan, the South Sudan Football Association board has suspended President Chibuo Gotch Alei. The board decided during an emergency extraordinary general meeting on Wednesday that Alei should step aside because of alleged financial impropriety. The South Sudan FA Vice President Andrea Abdella has taken over the presidency until the next election in March 2017. Chibuo Gotch Alei is reportedly determined to clear his name before a forthcoming General Assembly. He came into office in 2012 and survived being ousted in July before FIFA intervened. In athletics, 9-time Olympic champion Usain Bolt has won the IAAF Male Athlete of the Year award for a record 6th time. Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana, who broke the 10,000-meter world record by over 14 seconds in winning the Olympic gold in Rio this summer, won the female award. The 30-year Bolt sealed the triple-triple in Rio, winning his third Olympic title in each of the 100 meters, 200 meters, and 4x100 meters. Bolt will retire next year following the 2017 World Athletics Championships in London. Ayana, meanwhile, broke a record set 23 years earlier when she clocked 29 minutes, 17.45 seconds in Rio. The 25-year-old also won 5,000 meters bronze and won the diamond race. Finally, Yamane Tesgai of Ethiopia has won the 70th Fakwoka International Marathon. Running in difficult conditions on Sunday, the 31-year-old, who won the silver medal at the 2015 World Championships, clocked 2 hours, 8 minutes and 48 seconds to prevent two-time defending champion Patrick Makau from collecting a third straight victory. Hindered by steady rains, high humidity and relatively strong winds, which severely impacted the performances, Sagai's time was the slowest winning time since the 2004 edition. Makau was second, 9 seconds behind the winner. Kawauchi, on the rebound from recent injuries, was third in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 11 seconds. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports.
Love you, love you, love you. Go, go, baby.
Yes, it's Sunday here on Nelan Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent. Here we go.
Cause me sugar boy, I could give you what you want to make you dance. Liberia to Congo. All the girls they like me. From Liberia to Congo. Baby, dance with my song. I wanna see you move to the beat. Baby, dance with my song. I wanna see you move to the beat.
Omo Adeshiba, you know if I see you this smile, I don't get a fever. You're the one in my mind, you are my diva. I swear anytime I see you around, I don't get a ginger. Catchy, oh my darling, I want you to know you're the one where I go carry with my Ferrari. Baby, if you like, we go dance, we go party.
Yes, that was our Sunday music spot on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, one man's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. What an intriguing surprise. Here is a man who, on a Friday in 1994, carried out a coup d'etat against a democratically elected president and ruled the Gambia with a iron hand for 22 years. And now, on a Friday in 2016, he was defeated in a democratic election. How sweet it is. The intriguing part is this. President Yahya Jammeh, contrary to his authoritarian style, did allow his opponents to campaign freely in the Gambia. He also allowed the full operation of an independent electoral commission whose leader enjoyed the full confidence of all the contestants. Why? Perhaps President Yahya Jammeh was so confident that he would win and may have discounted the fact that the property developer, Mr. Adama Barrow, who was heading a 7-party coalition, would win. But there were also some ominous signs on the eve and the day of the election. All internet connections and foreign calls were halted and banned. He also said in an interview just after he voted that the Gambian should not demonstrate after the results were known. This means that he was confident that he would be the winner and was warning the Gambians not to protest against the results. When it was announced during the day that he had lost the capital, Banjul, that was not a surprise because many capitals in Africa often vote against the incumbent government. And his willingness to go ahead was not that foolhardy. Political experts concluded that President Yahya Jammeh was endorsed and supported by the older generation in the Gambia, who believe that he has done sufficiently in delivering political goods such as hospitals and schools, although the opposition said that these schools and hospitals were in numbers but not in quality. But it was also known that the youths in the Gambia were definitely against the government. And there were some statistics which were troubling. It was calculated that over 57% of Gambians have left the country, people, trained intellectuals, and that 14% of the youths were those taking the dangerous route to go to Europe through the Mediterranean, and many of them have lost their lives. So there was ground for the president to be somewhat confident. But then we began to see some dramatic events. The head of the Electoral Commission announced that Mr. Adama Barrow had won the election. But he also said, which was very intriguing, that President Yahya Jammeh had asked him to wait before announcing the results until he had conceded. Then we also heard that he was trying to videotape his concession. This was also very surprising. Hours went by, complete silence. And then finally, there was an interview with the winner, Mr. Adama Barrow, who confirmed that he had been called by President Yahya Jammeh and he had been congratulated and that he had conceded. But it was only in the evening on Gambian television that President Yahya Jammeh formally conceded and asked that he be allowed to assist in the transition. Now, Gambia has a major challenge. The first challenge will be for a smooth transition. And Mr. Adama Barrow and his supporters and coalition members should be very careful to treat the outgoing president with great dignity in order not to provoke any counter reaction. Second challenge for the Gambia is for the governing new president to be able to govern with great degree of dignity and unity in the Gambia. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. On behalf of all of us here at Nightline Africa, editor David Arnold, producer Odette Frazier, our engineer tonight, Michael Dubinsky, I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a wonderful week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to protecting religious minorities, their communities, and their culture worldwide. This is an important expression of the values of the United States, in that we want to protect diversity of thought and belief, said Knox Thames, Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South Central Asia. This effort, said Special Advisor Thames, is of great importance in Syria and Iraq, where ISIL or Daesh seek to wipe out much of civilizational history.
In that work, we saw where Daesh was committing genocidal acts against Christians, Yazidis, and Shia Muslims. At the same time that they were killing people, they were also trying to erase any evidence that they ever existed, destroying their churches, their mosques, their cemeteries. And if we were going to defeat Daesh militarily, we also need to take steps to protect the places that matter to these people that they're also trying to exterminate. And so from that work, we started focusing on protecting the cultural heritage of religious minorities.
The U.S. State Department partnered with the Smithsonian Institution to engage religious minority groups directly, providing them with training and information on preserving cultural sites and objects that are at risk. Some of these preventative methods are simple but effective, said Special Advisor Thames.
There was a training that went on in northern Syria where churches were trained about how to stack sandbags in front of ancient frescoes and murals, so that if a mortar shell were to land, the explosive force would be dissipated by the sandbags. It wouldn't hurt the mural. And they had these very striking before and after pictures of a room full of sandbags. The bomb tragically hit. The sandbags are exploded, but the mural is fine.
Trainings also include information on protecting movable artifacts by creating digital documentation of the items that can be stored remotely. The Smithsonian Institute has created a special outreach program in Erbil, Iraq, that is dedicated to the effort. These communities that are so unique, that create this mosaic of culture and religion, said Special Advisor Thames, they can be pieced together, and protecting their common culture can be a way to do that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.